I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Our conversation today is with Palestinian Sari Nusseibeh, who says Jews have an umbilical tie to Israel, and his family has over 1,000 years of history as well. The New York Times calls his new memoir a deeply admirable book by a deeply admirable man. But first, the 5-month-old ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinian Authority was buffeted by rockets fired toward Israel from the Gaza Strip yesterday. Militants linked to the Palestinian Fatah group claimed responsibility for this round. Earlier in the week, the militant group Hamas also fired a barrage of rockets at Israel. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas issued an appeal asking Israel not to carry out raids in Gaza, even as the Israeli Prime Minister's office says Israel will not be restrained forever. Well, we called up Greg Myrie for an update from the region. He's just wrapping up his stint as Jerusalem correspondent for the New York Times. Greg, put this in context for us. We're hearing from Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader. The truce since November is holding. On the other hand, there are rockets flying. What's happening?
Well, a little of both. This truce dates back to November and applied only to the Gaza Strip, not to the West Bank. And since that time, we have seen Palestinian missiles continuing to come out of Gaza. They have not caused a lot of damage or injuries, but Israel says it's something it cannot tolerate. And so this has been a growing point of friction. In the past few days, we've seen even a stepped-up barrage. And what was particularly significant is Hamas said that it was firing these rockets. It was upset at recent Israeli raids in the West Bank, which have been ongoing. And last week in particular, 9 Palestinians killed during these Israeli raids in the West Bank. Most of the dead were militants. But the truce, which had been shaky all along, now appears to have broken down. We haven't really seen a big upsurge in the violence going either way, but neither side seems as committed as they had been since November.
Well, let's stay with the Palestinian side. A Hamas leader is quoted as saying today that there's now a debate as to whether or not a truce is in the Palestinian interest, that it's not a clear decision. Do you have any idea who the debate is between?
Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader, clearly wants a truce and does not want missiles flying into Israel. He sees that as undermining his efforts to keep a dialogue going with the Israeli leadership. Yet militants in his own Fatah group have fired many of these missiles. Hamas in general had not been firing the missiles. This week on Israel's Independence Day, in fact, the militant wing of Hamas said it was going to fire rockets. So we see a confusion not only between Palestinian factions, but even inside some of these factions. So it's a very confused state as to what the Palestinians are going to do on this issue.
Well, neither side seems to be in a position to start a serious fight again. On the Palestinian side, Hamas is trying to get some world recognition and also put an end to the sanctions. In Israel, let's move there, a brewing scandal as to whether, before he was prime minister, Ehud Olmert helped a prominent billionaire in a bank sale. And there's also an upcoming Israeli government report that is said to likely be sharply critical of Olmert's administration's handling of the Lebanon war. So what is the mood in Israel?
Shimon Peres, the deputy prime minister, I think summed it up very well this week. He said the country is in a good state but a bad mood. And I think what he meant by that is this sort of paradox we're seeing in Israel now, where the economy is going well, the level of violence is quite low compared to what we've seen in the past few years. There's a lot of tourism, foreign investment. Using sort of traditional markers, things would seem to be going pretty well on the Israeli side. Yet there's a really glum, even depressed mood among Israelis. They feel their government has performed poorly. There's a lot of corruption. We're seeing a lot of several ministers who've had to resign or quit. The president is under investigation in a sex scandal. Olmert, the prime minister, is under investigation. The military did not perform well in the Lebanon war last summer. All of these things have really brought the mood down in Israel, even though, again, by these measures, things would seem to be going pretty well. So I think this is the sort of paradox we've seen in Israel for some time now.
Is it also completely stuck in the roadmap to peace? I mean, is there any sense of any movement at all towards a two-state solution?
I would say not in real terms, no. The roadmap, which was introduced almost 4 years ago, immediately stalled. Condoleezza Rice and the U.S. administration has tried to step things up recently, but it hasn't really generated any momentum or any real sense of optimism here. Perhaps the only thing we've seen has been a few, at least two meetings between Ehud Olmert, the Israeli prime minister, and Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader, but they haven't really gone anywhere. They haven't produced anything even sort of small on small issues, and certainly not on the larger issues in terms of talking about the two-state solution and getting back to full-fledged peace negotiations.
Greg Myrie, just wrapping up his stint as Jerusalem correspondent for the New York Times as he leaves Jerusalem to move to Washington. And Greg, thank you very much for your help while in Jerusalem.
My pleasure, as always.
Well, Palestinian Sari Nusseibeh is a descendant of one of the oldest families in this region. His father was the governor of Jerusalem and lost his leg in the 1948 war. For hundreds of years, a Nusseibeh family member has been charged with unlocking the door to the Christian Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where Christ is said to be buried. Sari was educated at Harvard and Oxford. His family lost land and homes when Israel was created. He was advisor to Yasser Arafat. And in the First Intifada, or Palestinian Uprising, he helped courier money to fighters. But Sari Nusseibeh learned Hebrew and worked in a Jewish kibbutz as a young man. He became a ferocious critic of Palestinian leaders, including Arafat. He says Jews have an umbilical tie to their land, that there can be no right of return for Palestinians, and they must reconcile with Israelis. He writes about all of this in a fascinating new book. It's called Once Upon a Country, A Palestinian Life. The New York Times calls it one of the best personal accounts of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict ever written. He's now president of Al-Quds University, the Arab University in East Jerusalem, and joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
I had to give that whole resume because it underpins, you know, everything we're going to talk about. But first, I want you to comment on the news, just your thoughts as we hear of more rockets flying.
Well, it's a very depressing situation. It's very frustrating because things aren't moving forward. The peace process is stuck, as we heard, and the talks between Mahmoud Abbas and Olmert aren't really leading anywhere. This does not mean that we can't go forward, but what's required, I think, is a dramatic international initiative led by the United States and the traditional mode of operating its diplomacy abroad just will not work to get us out of this mess.
Well, let's talk about what you think might. You've rejected violence in the region. You've called it evil. You've dismissed Hamas as an ideology. Hamas rejects Israel's right to exist, and you were one of the first to call for a two-state solution with Israel existing. Does there have to be a civil war between Palestinians for this to move ahead? Is that something that might unhinge this?
I don't think so. I think what needs to unhinge this is a serious peace process. And if we did have a serious peace process, and in particular, if we had a specific vision for the end game of the roadmap, namely the end to occupation, the occupation that began in 67.
On the part of the Israelis, of the land seized in the 67 war.
And the Israelis giving up the land seized, that's right. The establishment of a state with East Jerusalem as its capital, with a reasonable way to address the refugee problem, the Palestinian refugee problem.
What would that be? Because you say that there should be no right of return.
Not that there should be no right. The right, of course, exists. The question is, how do you deal with this right when you cannot, through a negotiated settlement, in fact, implement the actual return of Palestinians to their ancestral homeland?
How do you do it? It's impractical.
So what is required is a kind of balancing between rights. And in this case, I think that the new Palestinian state can receive as many Palestinian refugees as wish to come and live in Palestine. And the Palestinian refugees that wish to come and live in Palestine, not in their original homes, but at least on their homeland, can share as equals with the Palestinians that are living there, to create a new future for themselves.
So I want to be clear. So where are these Palestinians coming from, and where would they go to in your...
Well, you know, the refugee problem was created back in 48. And today it is said there are about, 10 million Palestinians, and maybe 5 million Palestinians live abroad. Not all of them will wish to come back. But first of all, we need a recognition of the plight, a recognition of the pain and the suffering that the Palestinians have gone through.
And it's sort of a reconciliation?
A kind of reconciliation, but that's part of it. And the other part is, to go back to the UN resolutions that relate to this matter, we need to think about material compensation for the losses and for the psychological suffering that people went through. And then finally, we need to look at ways and means of rehabilitating those Palestinians, those that want to go on staying in the Arab countries where they now live, perhaps being allowed to do so as equal citizens in those countries. And those who, on the other hand, wish to come back to a Palestinian homeland, being allowed to come back to the future Palestinian state. A combination of means, in fact, quite similar to what was called the Clinton formula on refugees, needs to be implemented.
Well, you speak of some of the things that Israel should do, for instance, in giving up some of the occupied lands. And many on the left in Israel have obviously begun to think of that as well. But how are the Palestinians, it's a terrible phrase, but how are they blowing it? I mean, what would you see on that side?
Well, look, it is true that it looks like we're demanding the Israelis to give up on settlements, give up on territories, and so on and so forth. But on the other hand, the establishment of a Palestinian state and the withdrawal of the Israelis from the occupied territories of 67 is also something in Israel's own interests. Because if Israel continues to occupy the territories with more than 3.5 million people now who are Palestinians, together with the Israeli Palestinians counting, adding up to about 5 million or 4 million Palestinians, in no time we will be in a situation where in Israel and Palestine we will have straightforward apartheid. And, Israel is not going to stand for that kind of situation for itself. So it's in Israel's interest to find a solution to the Palestinians.
You say this is a demographic issue.
It is a demographic, ethnic, national issue. And if the Israelis do wish to establish for themselves a state that's predominantly Jewish, they have to, therefore, address the other problem, which is the problem of having so many Arabs. And, it is good that the Arabs, at least, are saying to the Israelis, we're prepared to reach peace with you. And, not only the Palestinians, but the Arab countries combined met recently and reiterated their offer Israel.
Well, some are, and that leaves the problem of Hamas and the militants and also of the Palestinian government. I just want to just pull out some of the things you've written in the book because you are fiercely critical of Palestinian leadership as well. You write of the Palestinian Authority, it's developing a sleazy Arab kleptocracy. The Second Intifada was a catastrophic slapdash brawl, a fit of madness. Hamas is throwing shackles on the mind. We have about a minute before we're going to take a break, but how do you fix that side of the equation?
You fix that by bringing about rational solutions, solutions that appeal to the common sense of all human beings on both sides of the border alike. Ideologies that are radical, that are fundamentalist, simply are that. They're ideologies. We should look beyond the ideology to the human beings behind them. And it is the human beings we should address. And in this case, give something, offer something useful to the human beings, and the situation will change. And the ideology will be supported by less people.
Jobs, things like that are things you speak of. This is Sari Nusseibeh, president of Al-Quds University in Jerusalem, and also the author of the new memoir, Once Upon a Country, A Palestinian Life. When we come back, we'll talk more about how he views what he has always called for, the two-state solution in the Middle East, and also a little how you came to this thinking as a young boy who never saw a Jew. That's all after a quick break here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Sari Nusseibeh. His new memoir is called Once Upon a Country, A Palestinian Life. It's getting rave reviews. He's now president of Al-Quds University in Jerusalem. And I just want to ask you, we were talking about how you came early on to the conclusion that Jews deserved a homeland in the region. And we said you worked on a kibbutz, and you write how you were just so taken with the spirit there. But before that, long before that, you were in this prominent Palestinian family when the region was divided up by the fledgling UN in 47-48. Your mother and grandmother were expelled from their home. They had to walk to East Jerusalem. You were born almost the next year. You and Israel born almost at the same time, entwined since then. But what did you think of Jews when you were growing up?
Well, not very highly. They had been the cause of the suffering, as I saw it, as I was taught it, of the Palestinian people. You referred to my mother and grandmother, but you were talking about a large number of Palestinians mm-hmm. who were dispossessed, whose lands were confiscated. Till today, you know, the families, most families, a lot of families, in fact, Palestinian families have been unable to, since that point in time, to return and live in their homeland. So it was clearly a cause for a great deal of suffering, and I knew that the Israelis were behind it.
And if you saw Jews at all, you were taught that, and if you saw Jews at all, because I rush to say that you later learned that the Arab countries surrounding the Palestinians did very little to stand up for the Palestinians at that time.
There were a lot of, one can distribute blame all around.
Right. But as a child also, you write about catching glimpses of Jews out your window.
And it so happened that the people that lived just across from the backyard of our house were 100 meters away or so, across something called No Man's Land, were actually the religious Jews dressed up in black, with looking very, very, very distinct, and certainly, in a sense, from the point of view of someone who'd never seen a Jew before, even a little bit terrifying if you sort of connected the image with the stories that you heard about the dispossession.
And then I'm going to jump ahead. You go to school abroad. The 67 war breaks out. You have to fly back into the region. And you fly through Tel Aviv.
That's right. I fly with Israelis and Jews on an Israeli aeroplane coming from London to Tel Aviv. I land in Tel Aviv, which was very peculiar. It was mind-boggling to be flying into that part of the world from the west and not from the east, as I normally would have done. And then driving, in a car, again, a car full of people who are Israelis or Jews, whatever, talking Hebrew. Driving towards Jerusalem again from the west, which is a totally new experience for me, and passing through the areas, the lands, the fields, houses sometimes that my parents had taught me to have been, at one point the property of Palestinians. It was very peculiar.
But you're seeing, feeling. At that time also, seeing, hey, they appear to be human.
Of course, they're human beings. They look quite ordinary. They're not the kind of strange creatures I'd imagined them to be. And slowly, I was burning with curiosity. I mean, the very next morning after I arrived, the first thing I did was to jump out of the backyard of our house and walk the 100 meters or whatever it was to the Israeli quarter. And I would take a few steps, and each few steps I would take, then I would stop and then look back at my house because I wanted to see how I looked from the other side. And, I did this until I reached the Jewish quarter, and I tried to imagine myself in the garb of those strange-looking Jews at the time that I thought, and what they thought as they looked towards me in my own backyard, standing and looking also peculiar.
With this kind of examination, you became a philosopher, which helped with the way you looked at the world. But now, fast forward, here you are in such an interesting position. You were beaten up once by Palestinian thugs because you dared to go meet with the right-wing Israeli party. You were, on the other hand, arrested by Israel twice because they suspected you of fomenting violence. You're despised by some on the right in Israel because of your call for giving up the occupied lands, despised by some Palestinians because of your call for Israel's right to exist. How do you go through a day there?
I think it's very simple, by maintaining one's sanity and maintaining the most important thing in one's life, I believe, as a human being, which is the recognition, the continued recognition of the fact that one is above all, above everything else, a human being, rather than a man or a woman or a Jew or a Muslim or a Christian or an Israeli or a Palestinian, and seeing life and the world through the eyes of a human being, and therefore realizing that you are just as much of a person like the other guy.
But, we come to the same place we always seem to be at in this discussion. You and I have spoken before, you in Jerusalem and here. So how do you go from there to people in Israel who say, that's fine, but I cannot trust that there might not be a suicide bomber or someone who doesn't acknowledge my right to exist on the other side, or a Palestinian who says, that's fine, like your mother, but I can't get over the fact that I lost my house?
Well, there are no options, really. If one lives in... I mean, one cannot deny the fear And one shouldn't perhaps deny the fear that exists and will continue to exist. But one has to find a way to live with this fear and to not let that fear become the master of one's actions or inactions. One must learn to be the master of that fear. And I think in terms of the Israelis and the Palestinians, we have no options. Either we allow the fear to be master, in which case we will continue arming ourselves to the teeth and shooting at each other, or we take a risk. And the risk is the risk that's based on trust and faith in a possible future, faith in the goodness that there may exist in human beings, and the possibilities of a proper solution.
This is unfair. I've only got a few seconds. So I'm going to ask you to answer this very simply. What do you say to those who say, you are the good Palestinian, on the Palestinian plantation, if you will, and that you don't represent other Palestinians?
Well, I think I represent most Palestinians in my emotions, in my feelings. I'm not alone in this. And majority of Palestinians want the same kind of peace I wish for.
Sarah Nusseibeh, president of Al-Quds University in East Jerusalem. He was also the PLO's chief representative in Jerusalem and has rejected violence in the region, advocating a two-state solution to settle the Arab-Israeli conflict. His new book is Once Upon a Country, A Palestinian Life, a terrific read. Sarah, thanks so much for coming into the studio to talk to us.
Thank you very much, Robin.
More after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The first presidential debate of the 2008 campaign, held last night at South Carolina State University, seemed most notable for its lack of gaffes or fireworks. The Democratic hopefuls united in their attacks on the Bush administration and the war in Iraq. Gun control was an issue. At one point, the candidates were asked to raise their hands if they ever had a gun in their home, and five of the eight candidates did. At another point, the candidates were asked why they'd come to South Carolina when the NAACP had asked for a boycott of the state because of a display of the Confederate flag. The answer, in a nutshell, because Jim Clyburn invited us. Well, Jim Clyburn is a Democratic congressman from South Carolina. He's the House Majority Whip and the state's highest-ranking congressional politician. He's been called the kingmaker of South Carolina, and he joins us now on his cell phone. Congressman, welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I do want to ask you about that point where your name came up in the evening. The candidates were asked in a question, I believe, from the audience, about this NAACP ban on travel to South Carolina because of the display of the Confederate flag flying on the lawn of the State House. Until it's removed, the NAACP wants tourists not to come to South Carolina. Do you disagree with that ban, or what was your thinking in inviting the candidates in?
Well, you may recall when this issue first came up, and I've been writing and talking about this issue for more than 30 years. In fact, quite frankly, I was one of the first people to call for taking the flag off of the State House and out of the chambers of the House and the Senate. A compromise was met, a compromise that all of the black legislators voted for, and that was to take the flag off of the State House, take it out of the House and Senate chambers, and put it on the grounds of the State House. That was a compromise which I supported. Though the flag is located in a different place than the compromise originally called for. But when that compromise fell apart, then the pro-flag people decided that they would move the flag to a more prominent place, a place which I disagree with. But I do believe that it's time to move on and revisit this issue at a later date. And one of the things I wanted to do with bringing this debate to South Carolina, few people realize that in 1968, there was also the loss of three lives on the campus of South Carolina State University, and nobody talked about State College. I thought that bringing this debate to that community, to that university, would help us turn a page and get that sordid history behind us.
Well, and to fill out that event that you mentioned, 1968, three students were killed in a gun battle with police after protests against a segregated bowling alley. This in 1968, as you said. Barack Obama said last night that he felt that the Confederate flag should be put in a museum. Senator Biden, the one who cited you, said that he thought it was best to show off the incredible capability of an historic black college and to shine the light on the school. But just the question, kind of reminds us of how complicated politics are in your state, how long and complicated the history is. Given that, Do you think, as some have said to us, that Democratic candidates in particular have to sort of walk an interesting tightrope in appealing to voters in South Carolina? What do you think they have to do?
Well, I think they have to be themselves. I think they have to put everything in the proper perspective. And I think that Senator Biden put that in a proper perspective, and so did Senator Obama. Senator Biden said that it was important to shine a light on South Carolina State University and these incredible students. South Carolina State University has given this country more African-American general officers than any other school in the United States of America. So at some point in time, we have got to put the Confederate battle flag in its proper perspective and not let that be the sole arbiter of whether or not we make any further progress in the state of South Carolina.
Well, South Carolina's primary is expected to be held January 29th. That's 2 weeks earlier in the past. And I understand you wanted it to be held earlier so that black voters, perhaps many from this college, could have a greater impact on the election. Let's talk about that impact. Is it a given, as some people would assume, that black voters in South Carolina are going to vote for the black candidate?
No, that is not a given. And I think that if you were on the campus last night, you would have seen a tremendous number of African-American students wearing Hillary Clinton paraphernalia. A tremendous number of students. I was surprised at the number of students who were out there for Joe Biden. So I think last night, some people did themselves a lot of good. Some people did not do themselves as well.
I want you to stop there, Mr. Kingmaker. Who do you think did well? Who didn't do well?
I think Hillary did very well last night. I think that Joe Biden did very well last night. And though Richardson, I think, was good on substance, all told, the front runners remained the front runners, and the second tier candidates made some, Richardson and Biden took some risk.
Well, how about Barack Obama? Recently in your state, there was quite a kerfuffle when State Senator Robert Ford said that nominating Obama would be a disaster for the Democratic Party because whites nationally would not vote for him.
I think he was dead wrong about that issue. My daughter, Mignon, serves on our Public Service Commission. She is elected to that position from the same congressional district that I am elected from. She is the same age that Obama is. I would be very insulted if anybody said to me that they could not vote for my daughter because she was not a part of the civil rights stuff or that because she is black. I marched when I was a student in Orangeburg. I went to jail a number of times, sometimes in the company of John Lewis. We did all that so our children would not have to do it. We marched so Obama could run. Blackness should not be held against him any more than Hillary Clinton's gender should be held against her. We should all get beyond that and stop having those kinds of discussions and think about where we can take this country for the future of our children and grandchildren.
Well, Congressman Clyburn, we know you're on your cell phone in your car and have a lot to do today, but couple last questions. South Carolina, a Republican stronghold. The governor's a Republican. You're one of two Democrats from South Carolina in Congress. The most prominent African-American politician in South Carolina. Your endorsement is an important one. Have you? Are you going to make one? Can you make one now on her program?
I don't think so. I think January 29th is the election day. I promised the South Carolina Democratic Party that I would help them keep the primary in South Carolina, and I would not do anything that would in any way denigrate or make this primary inconsequential. But we could get to January, and you look around, there are only two people left in the race. And at that point, there may be one of them that I would much rather be president over the other, at which time I would get into it.
Congressman Clyburn, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. Still to come before we go, how good food and good company keep a 25-year veteran of the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater going strong. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, now it's time for your thoughts. We spoke recently with Dr. Ben Sachs and nurse manager Barbara Stabile of Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital here in Boston about changes the hospital made after a newborn died. Natalie Boberg of Farmville, North Carolina wrote, "I was impressed that the doctor and nurse had the integrity to publicly admit mistakes and take steps to correct them. But I was disappointed that one of the steps was to display the fetal monitor tracings on the large board at the nurse's station. Don't they realize that replacing human interaction with a machine is part of the problem? A laboring woman and her baby are much more than a readout from a machine, as sadly shown by this tragedy." We also spoke this week with Lori Griffin Burns, the author of Tracking Trash, that book about the flotsam and jetsam littering the world's oceans. John Faulkner of Hartsville, South Carolina, sent along his own observation. He writes, "In the 1980s, I used to regularly sail from New York's Long Island to Cape Hatteras. About halfway between, my boat would be covered with houseflies. For years, I couldn't figure out where they came from. Finally, I found the answer. The garbage scows from New York were dumping city garbage, and the flies were jumping ship before they drowned." To our war coverage now. After this week's Senate hearings on the misinformation campaign surrounding soldiers Pat Tillman and Jessica Lynch, Daniel Salato of New Bern, North Carolina wrote, "As an active duty Marine, I take offense at the repeated use of the word military in reference to the lies perpetrated in describing the Pat Tillman and Jessica Lynch stories. Please place the blame squarely where it belongs, on the U.S. Army." This week, we also spoke with Jeff Stein, National Security Editor for Congressional Quarterly, about recent House hearings on renditions, secret arrests and imprisonments, and their impact on world opinion of the U.S. Well, John Kirk of Needham, Massachusetts, sent his thanks. He also sent this song he'd already written. He performs it here with his son Jackson. It's called Extraordinary Rendition. What are you doing in our name, kidnapping, torturing soldiers? Extraordinary rendition. That's what we like about you, emails, and so much more. Well, it's been a rough news cycle, and that's reflected in your letters as well. We remember journalist David Halberstam this week with Cong Trang, David's translator and friend in Vietnam. We mentioned that David had looked forward to being Cong's guide if Cong ever got to the U.S. Well, that prompted Jen Moskowitz of Brookline, Massachusetts, to write, "I was fortunate enough to travel throughout Vietnam in 2001 with my husband. The altar Cong spoke about creating for his friend David Halberstam is what brings me solace in my own sudden loss of my husband. I'd be honored to be Cong's guide if he ever does make it to the U.S. And Judith Englander writes, "I listened as I drove to Concord, New Hampshire. As moved as I was to hear of this needless tragedy, I didn't expect to mourn for David Halberstam. Yet when Cong Tran said that now he would reread Halberstam's books in order to visit with his now-deceased friend, my sobbing started in earnest, and I had to pull over into the appropriately named breakdown lane. Thank you for this moving tribute to a true journalistic hero." And then there was the Virginia Tech shooting. During our coverage, I shared some personal comments about having a relative with mental health issues. Well, we received many notes, like this one from Louise Sherman, who lives in both Leonia, New Jersey, and Sandy Ridge, North Carolina. She writes, "At your story, I broke down with sobs. I'm the grandmother of a mentally ill teenager still struggling with his demons. I listened to the week's events with great sorrow for the families of the victims and of the shooter. They tried to get their son help. Not easy for people from another culture with little English. I hope there will now be a renewed call for better treatment and medical insurance equity for the mentally ill." And finally, remember Don Imus? His use of the phrase nappy hair? That seems so long ago. But one last comment on that subject comes from Mark Stevenson of Tucson, Arizona. After our reporting, he wrote, "I'm surprised you didn't play out with Stevie Wonder's song, I Wish. Check out the first line or two of lyrics." So we will. You can send your thoughts to letters@here-now.org or give us a call at 617-358-0397. Please remember to give us your name and hometown. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. What does a 25-year veteran of one of America's most popular dance companies do to stay healthy and happy when on the road for more than half of each year? For a quarter century, Renee Robinson has performed some of the most energetic dancing on stage with the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater. She's now somewhere in her 40s and is the last of the dancers handpicked by Ailey for the predominantly African-American company before his death in 1989. Well, she's found many ways to stay at the top of her game, as Here Now's Lynn Menegon found out backstage in Boston yesterday. It starts with food.
I try to be very specific about the things that I choose to eat. That is not to say I dislike potato chips. I like potato chips way too much. I enjoy a burger now and again and French fries with it. But I'm a huge, huge fan of leafy green vegetables. You know, a lot of people ask us, how do we keep our bodies looking so good? And then they will end up at a reception with us and they'll see how much we eat. And they're surprised.
In fact, the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater has special equipment to help feed its dancers.
We do a lot of cooking, a lot of grilling, a lot of smoking. This is an upright smoker. We also have two other grills, and then we also have two deep-fat turkey fryers that we do for turkeys and fish fries and stuff like that.
E.J. Corrigan is the technical director for the company, a trained chef.
And Ted Morrell.
Head of morale? What does that mean?
Well, you know, when you tour as much as we do, it's important that people do things together other than go to work every day, you know, so.
How often do you do the barbecue?
Pretty much 60% of the stops. We cook at some form or another.
Where do you do this?
Right out here.
Where's here?
Right outside the scene dock here.
This is like a little courtyard, and no one can see you're here.
This will be Barbecue Central here Saturday.
Do you have music? Do you have?
Yeah, we turn the music on. I mean, we travel together, we live together, we eat together. You know, we try to take care of them this weekend. I mean, that's what we do as a road crew. You know, they're our foremost concern everywhere we go. Their safety, their well-being, their vibe, their energy. You know, the energy that we set when they come in the building is the energy they begin with. That's the energy they feed off of.
That kind of loving support is part of what has kept Renee Robinson going.
I started with the company 25 years ago, and I've stayed because, I don't know, when I think about the beauty of the company, I not only think about the wonderful dancers and all of the great travel, but I think about some of the great words that Mr. Ailey said about his company, what he wanted his company to embody, represent, and two things come to mind. And one is that he wanted to hold up a mirror to society to show everyone how beautiful they are. And the other thing was that dance comes from the people and that it should always be given back to the people. Those words always kind of ring inside of me somewhere deep, deep inside. And sometimes the words, you know, come to the forefront when things get a little tougher. Most of my years have been spent under the direction of our great, great artistic director, Miss Judith Jamison. And a lot of times she will say to us, you know, oh, that was a great tour. You had a great season. But I need you to raise the bar higher. And I've added a joke to that, that she not only really wants the bar higher, she also wants you to do a big, big grand jeté over that bar.
As the bar gets higher,
you get older.
How do you...
Well, that's good. You know, I've noticed that too. The bar is getting higher and I am maturing more with the years. I could think of that two ways. I could think of it as I mature, the bar is too high. But I could also think of it as I mature and the bar gets higher, I have to tap into what the youth has to tap into, your energy, your excitement about what you're doing.
How do you maintain that sense of urgency and excitement in a dance piece like Revelations? I remember reading that it's voted the most popular dance piece ever. It's just seen all over the world, and it's beloved. It's to traditional spirituals.
Wade in the water, children, wade in the water, 'cause it's gonna trouble the water.
It's performed at almost every performance. I mean, how do you keep it fresh?
You know, I've thought about that question over the years, and it seems very limited for me to say that I keep it fresh, you know, by having good rehearsals and having wonderful people who make sure that we stay in line. But it's so much more than that.
I wanna be ready. I wanna be ready. I wanna be ready, Lord, ready to put on my long white robe.
Lord, I want. The music is great. It is a ballet that, just like in with any great work of art, there's always simplicity. There's always simplicity. Everything, the music, everything says the same thing, that it is about a spiritual journey, so to speak. And no matter who you are, no matter where you live in the world, you get it.
Came to an audience question and answer period after one of the Boston performances of the company. Someone in the audience asked, how do you dance in bare feet, which is what you often do. And one of the dancers said she melts tape onto the bottom of the balls of her feet.
Yes.
Do you do that?
You know, I used to many years ago. I do tape my feet only if I get a split. I have been lucky that over the years, for some reason, the way I take care of my feet, I don't know if it's the way I'm working, or not so many of my ballets are barefoot, I don't get as many splits in between the toes or under the toes. Sometimes you might be in a ballet where it's just a lot of turns, and you do put this kind of elastoplast, is what it's called, type of tape, because the tape is also stretchy. And then you maybe have a lighter and you move it along the tape, not onto the tape, but just a little bit away from your foot. And what it does is it makes the tape gooey. It adheres itself to all the crevices and the shape of your foot, and it works really, really well.
So you actually put the tape on your foot and then you melt it?
And then you melt it. And then you melt it just a little.
So kids should not try this at home.
No, they should not. Do not try this.
How much longer do you think you'll be dancing?
You know, that's always an interesting question to me because I had not planned for it to be this long. And I'm listening to God and listening to my body, and I'll go with that.
Here, Nazlyn Menegon spoke with Renee Robinson of the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater here in Boston yesterday. For the company's recipe for barbecue rub, go to our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Kathleen McKenna, our senior producer. You go, girl. I'm Robin Young. She's dancing. Have a great weekend and join us again here and now.
Comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.